Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Now, what it's like to live with a criminal record in America. A lot of us have one, as many as one in three Americans. And the shadow of a record follows us into the jobs that we want and the colleges that we're applying to, the training we need, the housing we're seeking, the credit we're trying to build. A criminal record can close a lot of doors for a long time. So today, we're going to talk about what it's like to encounter those closed doors and some of the experiments that are going on to change this. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear what this means in your life. If you or someone in your family has a criminal record, what's it meant to your everyday plans and your ambitions for the future? And if you've been the victim of a crime, are you skeptical about methods to lift the record of that criminal record? So if this is something that you've dealt with in your family or personally, I think it would be meaningful for us to hear about what it means for your everyday plans and the ambitions that you have for the future. But if you've been the victim of a crime, you may come to this conversation skeptical about some of these experiments to lift the records of these criminal records. So talk to me about that this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Lauren Leonard is with us. She's executive director of Mission Launch. It's a nonprofit organization that advocates for self-sufficiency for people who have been incarcerated. And she's with us today from Baltimore, Maryland. Lauren, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Alexandra Natapoff is with us, a former public defender, now a law professor at UC Irvine, and the author of the just-published book, Punishment Without Crime. And she's with us today from Irvine, California. And Alexandra, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
Lauren, we're having the conversation on a day when Florida is going to begin registering convicted felons to vote. This is something that the citizens of Florida decided in the last election. In the whole pantheon of coming out of a criminal record and trying to, you know, put your life back together again, how important is this?
This is critically important, and it's kind of one of those things where if you have always had the right to vote, it may be easy to take it for granted. Because the way that our society is structured, your ability to vote is really how you express the issues that matter to you, especially locally. So to be able to restore the vote for people who, in one sense, have had to participate in a society that they can't even really advocate for themselves in is critically exciting and a big moment, actually, for the country.
Alexander, I'm interested to hear your view on this. I mean, how did we go from, and Florida is one of those states that I would still say is pretty entrenched in the law and order culture. How do we go from that to this?
I think we're understanding as a community much better the costs of turning so many people into criminals. Florida, of course, is leading the way in many ways by helping reintegrate people with felony records into our democracy. But our system is even bigger than the felony disenfranchisement problem suggests. There are 13 million misdemeanor cases filed every year in this country. And while we don't always think of a misdemeanor criminal record as being the burdensome problem that felony records are, they also are interfering with people's jobs, their credit, their lives, their families. And it's an even bigger phenomenon. So I think we're on our way to understanding, one, just the scope of the problem, and then, two, hopefully backing off of being so punitive.
It was interesting, Alexander, to see that you call the misdemeanors the chump change, right, of the criminal justice system. But you say in the book, the American misdemeanor system often violates basic legal principles of fairness and justice. Can you tell me why before we take some calls here?
So our misdemeanor system is a very sloppy system. In effect, we're turning people into criminals. We're giving them criminal records without the kind of attention and due process, without giving them lawyers often. So we haven't really taken seriously the heavy burdens and the stigma of giving people a misdemeanor criminal record, even though it can be profoundly debilitating.
Because a misdemeanor sounds like a pretty light sentence, right? You wouldn't think that that's really going to affect so many different elements of your life. You're arguing that it does.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It doesn't sound that bad. It sounds like it's just a misdemeanor.
Right.
And because our criminal system is so harsh, because there are so many collateral consequences of a criminal conviction, even a misdemeanor conviction, it turns out that we're playing a little bit of a trick on ourselves. We call it minor. We call misdemeanors minor and petty. But for the people who are living through the experience of having such a conviction, actually those punishments are not petty at all.
Call here from Thomas in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Thomas. It sounds like you've had some experience with this. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. I was just recently pardoned after 33 years of living with two felonies from when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
The speaker is exactly right in that there is this idea of kind of the myth of redemption is what I would call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we actually live in is a really highly bureaucratic state that doesn't forgive. I'm lucky. I'm white. My father was college educated. I can read and write at a very high level. I could understand and navigate laws and rules better than a lot of people. And I was also in Minnesota. If I would have been in the South, I might still be in prison, or I might have never, you know, I would just have just been a recidivist and returned, because I would have never, ever gotten ahead in any way. Now, even then, despite all that, despite my successes, the fact that I've got not just a college, but I've got a graduate degree in the sciences,
mm-hmm.
You always live in fear. Is the one thing I need people to understand. Because no matter how far you are away from it, the legal system in some ways, one, and the corporate system, you know, like she said, credit checks and all this other stuff, it never forgets and it never forgives.
Thomas,
you could have,
let me, if I might, I want to hear Lauren Leonard on this. Lauren, what Thomas is saying is you may have satisfied all the requirements. I mean, he ended up getting a pardon, but
mm-hmm.
but the documentation of this, the bureaucracy of this is following you into a lot of places that you'd never expect. Is that right?
Absolutely. One of the things I would love to share with your listeners and kind of to validate Thomas's point is that 9 in 10 employers use a background check, 4 out of 5 landlords, and now 3 out of 5 colleges and universities.
Wow.
And we're lacking a lot of data, actually, around other places in which a background check comes into factor. We know it enters into some banking decisions, and some of the data is a little bit hard to find out there. So exactly what he's saying, which is even if you've been home sometimes for people 20, 30, 40 years, we're hearing stories of folks who go to apply for a home mortgage and are told basically that it's better for their family's approval rating if they actually come off the home loan, which means the family
wow.
qualifies for less of a property, potentially at a higher interest rate. So the fact that we have used the criminal background check, which was actually started for criminal investigations, not for traditional decision-making, but we don't have oftentimes better tools, and most people don't even understand how to read them, but it becomes a key gatekeeper in decision-making processes.
Thomas, is that why you sought a pardon?
Yeah, it was because of that and opening up possibilities in my life to get that cleared up. So, because, as I said, it's been 33 years. And with the background checks, there's only certain things that go that far back. But the fact is you're still denied things, and because as she says, the system is very black and white.
Okay. We have a lot of people on the line, Thomas, and I want to hear their experience as well. But I really appreciate the call and the insight that you're bringing to the conversation. Alexandra, I was reading up on, since I knew you were working and living in California, what California's approach is to this. Is it right that there are as many as 5,000 laws on the books in California to regulate how somebody with a criminal record lives and works after they've completed their service, their criminal conviction, their sentence?
Carrie, so if you're referring to...
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Alexandra. Lauren, I said to you, Alexandra, I was actually asking you about California. Go ahead.
Yes. So nationwide, every state has many laws that kick in, civil laws that kick in when somebody has a conviction, either a felony conviction or a misdemeanor conviction.
Okay.
And there are, at current count, about 50,000 of these laws nationwide. If you just looked up California and the number looks like to be 5,000, that sounds about right. What happens is that the system piles on. This goes to Lauren's point and also to Thomas's point, that the bureaucracy never forgets. And we've gotten into the habit of creating new laws preventing people, for example, from getting professional licenses or the inability to enter certain professions. There's even a law in some jurisdictions that say that if you have a criminal conviction, you can't go visit a family member who themselves is incarcerated just because you have that criminal conviction. So we've taken what was originally supposed to be a narrow, limited way of addressing a person's wrongdoing and really created this whole world of ongoing punishment.
And was the idea behind this, Alexandra, that we need to know who's going to live in, you know, this kind of housing, and we need to know who is going to be accepted onto our college campus, and we can judge what their character and potentially their future behavior by knowing that they have a criminal record? Was that what the assumption was?
Yeah, that really gets to the heart of the matter. What do we think it means that someone has a criminal record? So as Lauren pointed out, now the vast majority of employers and landlords are taking that as essentially a qualification. It's like part of your resume. And that's a really very problematic assumption, especially when we're talking about misdemeanors and low-level offenses and even low-level felonies, where we know people are getting swept into this net where people without opportunity and people in low-income communities are so easily swept into this net. We really need to rethink, what does it mean to have a criminal record? Should we be giving it this kind of weight? Or have we just gotten into this habit of treating it as a bar, as a disqualification, when it really doesn't warrant that at all?
This is a conversation, if you're just getting in on it, about what it means to live in America with a criminal record, and a lot of Americans experience this. Our guests with us, Lauren Leonard with us from Mission Launch, and Alexandra Natapoff with us, author of a new book called Punishment Without Crime. And your experiences with this, if you, someone in your family, is living with a criminal record, maybe doing some time now and facing the prospect of being out with a criminal record, what has it meant to your everyday plans, just your everyday life, and then to your ambitions for the future? But I also want to hear from those of you who are skeptical about the idea of, you know, removing the documentation of a criminal record. We're going to talk about some of the experiments that are going on in individual cities in some states. Are you skeptical about these methods and these experiments? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and we're on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Hearing from Heather here, who says that her 24-year-old daughter served 7 months at Shakopee. That's the Shakopee Women's Prison. for a drug charge. She's been out over a year. She's subject, she says, to regular frivolous harassment by law enforcement, and housing post-prison was the largest obstacle. To the phones to Bobby in Hutchinson, Minnesota. Hi, Bobby.
Hello.
Hi, what's your experience with this?
Well, mine goes back. I'm 44 years old, so 26 years ago when I was 18, I had a party and had a sexual relationship with a woman who I found out 6 months later was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She, it was a deal where she had stolen a car, showed up at the party. I didn't think nothing of it at 18. But like I said, I found out later she was underage. I did 32 days in jail. I did 10 years as a sex offender registration.
Oh, my gosh.
I was on probation
wow.
for 10 years.
Yeah.
And now I'm 44. I've been married for 20 years. I've got three kids. And to this day, I still cannot be a volunteer at my kids' school activities. I haven't gotten so much as a speeding ticket since then. It was obviously an isolated thing. I still have fear of employment finding out. I've tried to make it a good thing. I've gone to churches and schools, and I've talked to them about my experience and how one decision can change the rest of your life. But on the other hand, I look at it as I didn't go into a situation to do something wrong, but I did do something wrong. But how long do I got to deal with that? How, you know, 26 years later, I try to do stuff with my kids, and I can't.
Right. Well, I really appreciate the call. Lauren, can I ask what you hear in that experience, especially with this idea of the sex offender registration that follows you for so long?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the experience, again, is it kind of speaks to what Alexandra was also saying, which is we have structures and systems that are designed to never forget. And I would say that when it comes to issues around violence and sexual offenses, to be honest, those are typically the cases in which we, in one sense, turn a blind eye because we it's not that we can't figure it out. I don't believe in this country that we can't do hard things. I think in one sense, if we don't know what to do, we kind of freeze and pause and do nothing, but we're leaving millions of people, like your caller, basically stuck. And I've heard this experience a lot, which is parents years later, decades later, can't participate in certain events in their children's life, which then we have to consider the cost also to the whole family, the trauma to the kids, because we don't just incarcerate individuals. We lock up whole families because when people come home from prison or jail or once people have records, it's often their family, which is the first safety net that provides the layer of support.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the family becomes impacted as well.
Alexandra, what's the Minnesota was very aggressive, I should say, on these sex offender registration laws. California the same way? And what are your thoughts about what that means to, you know, your life for decades after?
You know, there's been a lot of advocacy and thought and litigation around these registration laws. The idea that in some sense you never pay off your debt to society. And we often look at these serious offenses, not to diminish the seriousness of sex offenses in any way, but we people do often commit serious offenses. And we have to think about what it is, as Lauren pointed out, what do we want to do about it as a community? What do we want to do about it as a criminal justice system? And I want to thank Bobby for his bravery in calling in and sharing his story with us and with all the folks that he's talked to about it, because it can be very stigmatizing. People are afraid to disclose that this has happened to them because we make it so difficult.
Right, yeah. Steve called to say, I'm a convicted felon. I've been through the system. I feel the system doesn't help people get back on their feet. I have no problem with punishment and consequence, but if someone has redeemed themselves, I think the system should be modified. One of the things, Lauren and Alexander, that's being done in, I think San Francisco is doing this and Milwaukee, Wisconsin has experimented with this, are these expungement clinics or proactive expungement. Alexander, how effective is that?
Yeah, so we need to say two things at once. One is that they're extremely important and we should do it.
Okay.
And that they are not always that effective.
Uh-huh.
It's very important to engage in expungement and sealing and to try to eliminate those records. But the reality is, in this modern day and age of data mining and big data and the data aggregators that buy criminal records, sometimes as soon as they're created, to resell to the private sector, it's really very hard to put that genie back in the bottle.
What do you think, Lauren?
I would agree. I think, you know, anything that we can do to begin to have conversations around, okay, you have a record, now what? Like, I think that that's where we need to move the conversation to a now what place.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have all the data. We don't even know really truthfully the real ramifications and costs of our justice system, just because there's so much stuff that's just second and third and fourth and fifth down the line once a person has a record. But I think it's time for us to really say now what, because to Alexandra's point, sealing and expungement is one thing. We also know, similar to the gentleman who called, people who have received pardons are still stuck as well, right? So we haven't figured it out, but I think we have to get ourselves to this place of really saying it's worth figuring out when a third of the population, that's 70 million people today, and we anticipate by the year 2030, 100 million people having a record.
Oh my gosh.
We're talking about more people by 2030.
Yeah.
So that's like saying we're going to have a third of the population relegated to an alternative class, and we don't even really want to figure out how we can potentially avoid that in the future. And with Alexandra's point, as big data, artificial intelligence, like all of this stuff is coming into play, having a record and the systems in which your record is posted in, we don't even really yet know the ramifications of that in the future.
So Lauren, if proactive expungement and expungement clinics are effective, but they're limited, they're having a limited effect, and the pardons, well, that is a long process. What else do you think is, you know, innovative in this? And maybe there's some states or cities experimenting with it.
Yeah, I would say that I'm beginning to see, you know, and I think we all are, nationwide states are deciding what they are willing to do. And this is kind of to the top of the episode or the session we're doing now,
mm-hmm.
is why Florida restoring the right to vote is really important, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of this change is going to happen at the state level. There are some things that can happen federally, but a lot of this is state by state. And so I think one of the things that we have done at Mission Launch actually is, as a result of our business accelerator program that we were helping folks start and grow their business here in the D.C. Baltimore region, we recognized the need for startup capital. The average business costs $30,000 to start. Coming home from prison or jail, you don't have access to that kind of money. And unfortunately, for most people, it's going to be debt, right? But when we started to look at lending and working with banks, we recognized the barrier there. Which led us to create an alternative background check, which is also an alternative credit score, right? So I think innovations in technology and also being mindful, again, that there is some tech around criminal justice that's actually extremely harmful, that's not helpful. But I think we have to get to this question of, it's going to take a bunch of things. There's no one-size-fit-all solution to a problem that's going to affect 100 million people, and diversity and how we address this is going to be probably our best bet.
Quick note here, Alexandra, before I go back to the phones. Minnesota passed Ban the Box. That is that initial, you know, having to admit that you've been, that you have a criminal record on an initial application. But the employer, as we've noted, can get that information very easily. How effective do you think those Ban the Box laws are?
Again, like expungement, like sealing, Ban the Box is a very important measure. As Lauren pointed out, we don't actually know exactly how all these measures are going to shake out in the real world, in the real marketplace, and in the employment context. Sometimes they can be counterproductive because they're operating in a world in which there's a lot of misunderstanding about what a criminal record really means.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of a lot of thoughtless reaction to just the mark on the piece of paper. I just want to double down on Lauren's point, which is that there are many, many efforts going on, but the bottom line is that we need to change our minds. I think that Florida is an example of that. Change our minds, not just about the rules and about the paperwork, but how we want to handle the fact of 100 million people with criminal records.
It's just startling.
And how we want them and their families to be able to thrive. Once we change our minds about the meaning of a criminal record, I think that these measures will reach their full effectiveness.
Call here from Reggie in Eagan. Hi, Reggie. What's your experience with this?
Hi, thanks for having me on. You know, I have family members that have been to prison, and they tell me about their experience and how they do jobs while they're locked up, you know, for big companies, operating earth movers, things of that nature. And they get like a dollar a day to do these things. And then they get out and they apply for the company that they were working for and getting praised while they were in prison, and they won't hire them.
Right.
So you got felons coming out of prison and, you know, they don't have any money. You can only get told no so many times before you resort back to what you know. And, they, you know, people wonder why the criminal system is a revolving door. It's because once you get that mark on you, it's like you're just staying for the rest of your life. And, you know, and unless you find a company who will give you a chance, it's just, you know, you just pretty much left to your own criminal devices.
Really good point here, Reggie. Lauren, let me bring this back to you. How about employment policies? We were talking about the technology of having access to these records, but how about individual companies' employment policies, especially given what Reggie just said?
Yeah, so that experience is unfortunately a very common experience. One thing that I will highlight here is for listeners who watch national news, oftentimes we may see very sadly wildfires in California. One thing that people don't know is they often take prisoners, people who are incarcerated, out of prison to fight wildfires, and yet you can't become a firefighter when you come home, right? So this concept of basically cheap and or free labor and companies investing in our criminal justice system and the privatization of our criminal justice system, benefiting from it but refusing to hire people, is very common. And it's also one of the reasons why, again, when I said 9 out of 10 employers use a background check, it's the reason why between 60 to 75% of people a year after being released still can't find employment. So I think to Alexandra's point, we have to change people's minds around what it means to have a record. We have to kind of redefine what it means to have a record. We also need to position, again, I come back to this, a third of the population as being a viable and strong workforce, a viable and strong consumer base. I think we kind of, again, push folks with records off to the side as if, you know, perhaps you've made a mistake or you've done something wrong, you've injured someone, you've harmed someone, and therefore you can never come back to society. But I mean, it's kind of, our system is designed to be, you're removed from society as your punishment, right? Mm-hmm. So if we are who we say we are as a country, that means when you come home, you should be restored to full citizenship. And that means access to a livable and fair wage.
Alan Eden Prairie called to say, I'm kind of torn. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. That's something Al says he agrees with. But the question for him has become, is there a problem in the judicial system, especially for younger convicts? How can we help them to rehabilitate? Sarah in Minneapolis called to say, there's a level 3 offender coming to my neighborhood. We got a flyer about his entire crime. I emphasize that because it's complicated. I'm fine with nonviolent issues, but when it's violent and sexual in nature, then people need to be aware of it to take precautions. And to the phones here, to Representative Ray Dean in Minneapolis. Representative, the session is starting this morning, isn't it? Good to have you listening.
Well, thanks, Carrie. Yeah, we start today at 12 noon, and I want to thank you for what I think is a really, really important conversation. Folks that don't know, I actually was convicted of a felony back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I received a pardon, and I was able to put my life on a course that was very different from what I was doing, you know, based around addiction and adolescence and all those other types of things. And, you know, as the discussion gets to the issue of employment, I think that one of the things, and I'll remind listeners, that Ban the Box passed in Minnesota because we had the support of many employers.
That's right.
And employers know that they're in an odd situation where they do background checks, but at the same time, the workforce is, you know, being hindered by many people with criminal records. So my hope is that employers will continue to be partners in this. And ultimately, it's a solution that's not just going to take place at government, but it's also a solution that's going to take place out in the private sector as well.
You know, Representative, I wanted to ask you something that came up earlier with Lauren and Alexandra. Do you think that as we see in Florida, Americans, average Americans, citizens, voters are ahead of where governments and politicians are on this issue, willing to say, as they did in Florida, yep, you get a second chance on being a voter.
Yeah, I think the people of the U.S. and the people of Minnesota are way ahead. And I think part of it is that, you know, it is affecting, you know, the criminal justice system is affecting so many people. So everyday people know someone either in their family or connected to their family or connected to a friend that has had these collateral consequences from an offense that may have been committed, as one person mentioned, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So I think the public gets it. And, you know, my hope is that my colleagues begin to get it because, you know, we need to be part of the solution. We're not the only solution. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I'm hoping that this session we'll be able to have some really good conversations around this. You know, there are nearly 350 licensed positions in the state of Minnesota that you can't do if you have a criminal record.
Wow. Good luck with the brand new session, and thanks so much for listening in and calling this morning. Alexandra, I want to ask you if you think Representative Dean is right that, you know, voters, citizens, as we saw with Florida, are often ahead of the curve on
yeah,
where
absolutely.
The...
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's wonderful that he called in to share his insights with us. So the book that I just wrote, Punishment Without Crime, is about the misdemeanor system. And it's worth remembering 13 million misdemeanor cases are filed every year. That's 13 million people and their families who have experienced the reality, the sort of the speed and the sloppiness of the criminal system. And so with 13 million cases filed every year, with 70 million people with criminal records, the American people understand that the system is not always doing what it says it does. It's not always fair. It's not always accurate. It's not always, doing what it says it's doing. And so I think that people do understand that we should be thinking about it differently. And it's really important to put good information in their hands.
Alexandra, thanks so much for the time this morning and for the book. Congratulations on the publication of it. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra's book is called Punishment Without Crime. I want to see if I can squeeze in one more call here from Kurt in Minneapolis. Kurt, you're a local prosecutor. Is that right?
Yes, I work for a couple of suburban cities.
Tell me what you're thinking about this discussion.
Well, Alexandra's book is fabulous, and it really highlights the problem that we have is that we have all these offenses that there needs to be a uniform system for expungement. But at the same time, you know, especially for misdemeanor offenses, the past behavior is the best indicator of future behavior. And especially in law enforcement, we need to look at those prior offenses, especially when we're aggravating future crimes, current crimes based on past conduct. And what we're seeing, and I think Representative Dean nailed it really well, is we have this patchwork quilt of collateral consequences that stem from convictions, but no good system for seeing expungements and then balancing it with the need of law enforcement to see past crimes.
It's a really, really good point. I'm a little tight on time. I wanted to hear Lauren on the call for a more nuanced assessment of a record and what it might say about, you know, your future interest or capability in committing more crimes, Lauren.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I think one of the I would agree that there, you know, I have a background in information systems, so I know data management, data mining is important in pattern assessment. But I would say that there's new research coming out that says that we can start to identify when a mindset shift happens. So even if a person has past behavior, the nuance that we're looking for would allow us to see perhaps when does a person wake up one day and say, I'm ready to change my life over? Because we know that that does happen, and that will take some time to identify. But I think it's time that we just decide, again, like, now what? We have this system. How can we make it better for, again, as a third of the population?
It's such a good point, because we don't want to be a culture that says, even if you've finally or whatever taken the step to change your life, there's no upside to that, right? Because we're still going to treat you like the person that you were before.
Exactly. mean, like, what we know is ego depletion, and a lot of the psychology around this is, again, it's to your caller's point. Once a person faces a certain amount of rejection, to be honest, there's an opt-out. And I think, again, as a society, we want people engaged. We don't want people opting out. And so if you're constantly being rejected, if you're only seen as your worst mistake, if you're never given an opportunity, in one sense, for the average person, you have to wonder, what's the point? And I think that is the danger and the harm of not fixing the system we have.
Lauren, really grateful you could be in on the discussion today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.